Shabbat Shalom. Turn to Genesis chapter 35. We'll do a little bit of reading, a little bit of work in the Torah portion, in this week's Torah portion. Genesis 35, beginning in verse 1, where it says, "Then God said to Jacob, 'Arise, go up to Bethel, and live there, and make an altar there to God, who appeared to you when you fled from your brother Esau.' So Jacob said to his household and to everyone who was with him, 'Put away the foreign gods which are among you. Purify yourselves, change your garments. Let us arise and go up to Bethel, and I will make an altar there to God, who answered me in the day of my distress, and has been with me wherever I have gone.'" So the Lord spoke to Jacob, the Lord speaks to Jacob and tells him, now that you're back in the promised land, the land of Abraham, the land of Isaac, your fathers, it's time to return to the spot where you first had the dream of the ladder and the angels going up and down. Go back to that spot, because Jacob had promised, he had made a promise when he was leaving the promised land. He had promised God, "If you bring me back to this place..." Well, let's find the text. Let's go find the text. It's in Genesis 28. Jacob had made a vow to come back to this spot, after he had that dream of the ladder and the angels. It says in Genesis 28, verse 20, "Then Jacob made a vow, saying..." Here's what he said. He said, "If God will be with me, and will keep me on this journey that I take, and will give me food to eat, and garments to wear, and I return to my father's house in safety, then the Lord will be my God. This stone which I have set up as a pillar will be God's house. And of all that you give me, I will surely give a tenth to you." I will give a tenth to you, a tithe to you. Now, when I read this text, I've always felt like it sounded like kind of a self-centered bargain. Like it's as if he says this: "If you will answer my prayers and do everything that I ask, then I'll let you be my God." It's like there's other gods in the running, though, you know? It's like, "Oh, I'm going to take this one or take that one." It sounds as if he has several gods who are in competition. And the one who meets his contingencies the best will receive the honor of being his God. This implies that if God doesn't meet Jacob's demands, he wouldn't be acceptable as his God. The problem is with the English translation here, because the Hebrew does not actually say, "Then the Lord will be my God." Instead, it says, "And the Lord will be my God." It's an "and." The sense of the passage is if God provides for him and returns him to the land of Canaan and will be a God to him, then Jacob will fulfill the vow he utters in the very next verse, where he says, "This stone which I have set up as a pillar will be God's house. And of all that you give me, I will surely give a tenth to you." This makes better sense. I think that makes much better sense. But what does he mean by saying, in the first place, what does he mean by saying, "If the Lord will be my God"? Perhaps Jacob means that he desires a personal relationship with God the same way his father Isaac had a personal relationship with this God, and in the same way his grandfather Abraham was known by this God, and to be known by God and to know God. Jacob wants that same kind of relationship. I don't know. The Hebrew here is ambiguous on... in this whole question of Jacob's vow, it's a little ambiguous. On the one hand, it sounds like Jacob is willing to accept the Lord as God over him only if his demands are met. "Then you will be my God," like I read to you. On the other hand, Jacob is committed to God, but he only desires deeper relationship with God. It's not a question of, "Yeah, of course God's my God, but I want to know more of him. I want to be closer. I want to have a deeper, more intimate relationship." And so he promises to show his gratitude by giving a tenth of his possessions to God. in both cases. But these two alternative passages, it's the same passage, the two alternative readings of the passage, I think these represent different approaches to God. You know, many people, we could, at least for the purposes of making a sermon out of an otherwise unrelated text, we could say this, you could put it this way. You could say many people approach God with an attitude of entitlement. Maybe you're not sure what I mean, but it works like this. If God will answer my prayers and meet my demands, like Jacob was saying here, like we thought Jacob was saying, only then will I favor him with the great privilege of me accepting him and becoming his follower. This is a very sorry way to approach the king. Imagine a beggar going to the king and saying, if you will give me everything I ask, I will allow you to be the king. Imagine a wife saying to her husband, if you give me the things I want, I'll let you be my husband. The king is already the king. The husband is already her husband. So God doesn't come to us, hat in hand, begging for our affirmation, nor does he come begging for our money. The man who properly understands his place in the scheme of things, he doesn't lay contingencies on God. We should love, we should accept, we should trust, and we should obey God because he's God. Not because he meets our personal requests. He's already God, with or without our permission. There's nothing we have actually to offer him that he needs. So if we willingly commit ourselves to him, no strings attached, he will certainly be our God. Just as he was the God of Abraham, and the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. But Jacob promises to give him a tenth. The word tithe simply means tenth. You've heard of tithes. Not from me, you haven't. We've never talked about tithing. I was trying to think how long I have been behind pulpits and doing this sort of thing. It's been I think it was in 2001 that I started doing Sabbath morning sermons. I've never discussed this concept of tithing. But I'm guessing that despite that, you've probably heard the term before. Tithing and tithes and tithes and offerings, right? Well, this is not. This is one of the first places that we find the tithe, the tenth, mentioned in the Bible. It's not the first time. Instead, the first time was when Abraham encountered Melchizedek, the righteous king of Salem. Abraham gave him a tenth, a tithe, of all that he had. So it's like one tenth. That seems to be the number. That's the magic number, so to speak. It's a concept in the Bible, the tithe. But I want you to note something with Abraham and Jacob. Note this well. Neither Abraham nor Jacob had a commandment to give a tithe. It was a mitzvah for them in the sense it was a good deed, but it was not a mitzvah in the sense of a commandment. It was not under compulsion. It was of their own free volition. God did not say, Abraham, Abraham, thou shalt bring me a tithe. There are, in the Bible, we will find laws of tithing, for sure, and we're going to look at them today in the Torah. In fact, the tithe is a really big piece of Torah law, but the concept of tithing does not originate with Torah. Instead, Abraham and Jacob, before they had ever received the Torah, they knew about tithing. Why is that? Before the Torah was ever given, Abraham and Jacob knew about tithing. Why? Because the tithe, the tenth, was a common standard in the ancient Near East. It was a common standard of taxation, or more pertinently, it was a standard of temple taxation. The temple cults of the gods of Mesopotamia, their priesthood, typically imposed a tithe, a tax of a tithe, that was what you paid to the temple and to the priesthood and the clerical class, 10%. So, tithing, it's not a biblical concept. It's a pre-biblical concept. Tithing was already well understood by the time of the patriarchs. So even though Abraham and Jacob were not under any compulsion to tithe, they didn't even have a commandment to tithe, the children of Israel, will later be given such a commandment. So, nevertheless, Abraham and Jacob, and Isaac probably too, they understood the concept. When Moses gives the Torah, later he will give commandments to the children of Israel to take a tithe. And so we're going to look at some of that. There's a certain amount of irony, though, when you talk about tithing. You know, and I've always, you know, I never wanted to really talk about this because there's been so much said about tithing because this is how churches support themselves. This is how we stay in business, so to speak, is by giving sermons about tithing. And it's kind of ironic because, you know, within greater Christendom, where it's commonly taught that the laws of the Torah are done away with and obsolete, except for this one. This one's still on the books. We're still yours. You got to give us tithe. It's right in the Bible, right? So it's kind of, there's some irony about that. You'll hear this passage all the time from Malachi. I bet you could quote this. Malachi 3:8 says, "Will a man rob God? Yet you are robbing me. But you say, how have we robbed you? In tithes and offerings. You are cursed with a curse, for you are robbing me, the whole nation of you. Bring the whole tithe into the storehouse, so that there may be food in my house, and test me now in this, says the Lord of hosts. If I will not open for you the windows of heaven and pour out for you a blessing until it overflows." This is the sort of thing, this is the sort of verse that you might hear on the radio any number of times throughout the day as radio programs are raising funds to stay on the air and that sort of thing. There's lots of confusion about this. Lots and lots of sermons. And a fair amount of gobbledygook that's out there. I get lots of questions. I mean, I know this because I get, like, emails. Lots of questions about, and people want to know about tithing all the time. So, I'm going to take a look at this. Tithes are a 10% collection taken from agriculture and produce as a donation to the temple system. So a tenth of the produce of the land, the fields, the orchards, the vineyards and everything, the Torah says a tenth of all this belongs to God. But here's a little known fact about tithing. The Torah does not demand one tithe, but two. There are two tithes legislated in Torah, which means that the total given amount is not 10%, but 20%. The two tithes are called Maser Rishon, first tithe, and Maser Sheni, second tithe. So, let's take a look at these two tithes. I'll show you some text. First tithe. For example, Deuteronomy, you don't have to turn here because we're not going to spend any time, but Deuteronomy 18:30 mentions it. It's the tithe of the threshing floor and the produce. All the produce and the wine vat. It's a tithe on fields, vineyards, orchards, agriculture, all agriculture in the land of Israel. What was done with the tithe? So if you're a farmer, you set aside 10% of your produce. The tenth was measured off, and like I told the kids, you give that to the Levites. The Levites, in turn, were responsible to give 10% to the priests, the descendants of Aaron. So it's pretty simple. It's pretty straightforward. It's a means. It's obviously a means to support the Levitical class, the priesthood and the Levites. Once a year, you would set aside a tenth of your harvest and give it to the Levites in your town. And it's a means of supporting the temple system. So in return, the Levites, they don't have land themselves. They live throughout Israel. And they're in charge of taking care of ritual matters for the community. With the priesthood, they have all sorts of responsibilities in the community, and not the least of which is to be teaching Torah to the community. But the main reason for their support was because they were required to serve in the temple. So, what this means is that the tithe and the laws of tithing are contingent upon several things. First of all, you have to be doing agriculture. So, if you're not doing agriculture, it doesn't apply to you. Secondly, the agriculture needs to be in the land of Israel. So, if you're not doing agriculture in the land of Israel, it doesn't apply to you. Thirdly, you have to have Levites to give it to. So, if you can't find any Levites, you don't know what to do with your tithe. Fourthly, the Levites have to be employed in the temple system. So if you don't have a temple going, your Levites can't really work with this tithe anyway. So if we're not meeting these four contingencies, you know, it doesn't apply to you. That's the first tithe. Second tithe. The second tithe, let's see, let's try Leviticus 27. Turn to Leviticus 27. We'll take a look at a couple texts here. Leviticus 27 is discussing the second tithe. It says, thus all the tithe of the land, in verse 30, of the seed of the land or the fruit of the tree is the Lord's, it's holy to the Lord. If therefore a man wishes to redeem part of his tithe, he shall add one-fifth to it. Why would you redeem part of your tithe? Suppose, for example, you had 10 goats. One of them is for the Lord. And the one that you labeled as a tithe, it's for the Lord. And so it's going to be sacrificed for the Lord as a tithe. But it turns out, as you take a closer look at your goat, it has a blemish. And now it's no longer qualified for sacrifice. Now you would have to redeem it. How do you redeem it? You substitute a different goat for the one that was going to be sacrificed and add a fifth of its value. That's what it says. So for every tenth part of the herd or the flock, whatever passes under the rod, the tenth one shall be holy to the Lord. He is not to be concerned whether it is good or bad, nor shall he exchange it. Or if he does exchange it, then both it and the substitute shall become holy. It shall not be redeemed. So you can't redeem your tenth. Why did it say that you can redeem it? Anyway, never mind. These are the commandments which the Lord commanded Moses for the sons of Israel at Mount Sinai. So, your second tithe, you're counting your animals, first of all. One, two, three, as they come out the barn door. The tenth one comes out, gets a red stripe or something like that, and it's a tithe. That's what it says in the Talmud. You count them as they come out. Tenth one, you got some red paint or something, slap it on there, and that one you know is to be tithed. As each tenth animal passes under the rod, it's tithe. Then you apply the same system to all of your produce again. But here's a question. Let me ask you something. Suppose you were a potter. 10 pots, you tenth pot, count off 10 pots, mark the 10th pot with red, and that one's a tithe. Or what if you were a sandal maker? You count off 10 sandals, and the 10th sandal you mark as a tithe? How do you do this? Well, you don't. Sandal makers don't tithe. Potters don't tithe. Nobody outside of agriculture tithes. The tithe is connected to the land. So you put these two tithes together and you come up with 20%, which is a lot. Now some of you come from the Worldwide Church of God background, Herbert Armstrong, and so you know this material pretty well, this tithing material pretty well, because in that church people actually did this, the 20% deal. 20% of their income. Now, this is just sort of an aside, but let me tell you something about people from the Worldwide Church of God background. As I travel the Messianic movement, I'm very grateful for the Worldwide Church of God, because when the Worldwide Church of God decided they were no longer going to be keeping the Sabbath, all the people fled, and they came into Messianic congregations, and we've profited much from the meltdown of that denomination. But I have consistently noted about these people that they are successful. You know, not in every case, but generally speaking, they are successful people. They are not living in the poverty of the Messianic movement. They are usually business owners, entrepreneurs, and so on, occupying higher level management type positions. Why is that? I mean, it's just an observation. I think there's two main reasons. The first was that they had a priority on education and higher education. They did. They had their own colleges. So I think that's part of it. A grasp of the value of education. But the second reason is that they had this 20% tithe to deal with every year, and that forced them to have their finances together. When you're setting aside 20%, for the Lord, you better have a budget. You better know how to manage your money. And they had to manage their money in a way that most of us never do. And finally, I think that God blessed them for giving faithfully. Even though in reality, you know, they weren't farmers in the land of Israel, and it's unknown to most of them, they're under no compulsion to be giving a tithe. But nevertheless, God blessed them for it. So anyway, second tithe, we're talking about tithing. There's another text on this. You might think, you know, as I'm reading about this second tithe and, you know, marking the animals as they come out the barn door and so on, you might think, well, then you give that to the Levites too, but that's not the case. The first tithe we gave to the Levites. The second tithe, you know what you do with the second tithe? You keep it! Check this out, Deuteronomy 14. Deuteronomy 14, beginning in verse 22. It says here, "You shall surely tithe all the produce from what you sow, which comes out of the field every year. You shall eat in the presence of the Lord your God, at the place where He chooses to establish His name, that is the temple. You shall eat the tithe of your grain, your new wine, your oil, and the firstborn of your herd and of your flock, so that you may learn to fear the Lord your God always." So, here's what God says. Tithe everything, take the tithe, and eat it. Use it. Bring it up to the temple. Go to the temple and eat it at the temple when you go up to celebrate the festivals. Now, what if it's too far away, though, for that? It says, if the distance is so great that you are not able to bring the tithe, since the place of the Lord your God chooses to set His name is too far away from you, when the Lord your God blesses you, then exchange it for money, and bind the money in your hand, and go to the place which the Lord your God chooses. So, suppose that you had, you have a pretty good-sized tithe, and you have bushels and bushels of grain. So what are you going to do? Carry these bushels and bushels of grain to Jerusalem at Sukkot, find a miller, have him mill it, make bake bread, and then try to eat all the bread there. And it's not going to... There's got to be a better solution. So the Torah says, okay, if that's the case, just sell it and take the money to Jerusalem. Just bind the money in your hand. Take the money to Jerusalem. What do you do with the money when you get there? Verse 26 says, "You may spend the money for whatever your heart desires. Oxen, sheep, wine, strong drink, whatever your heart desires. There you shall eat in the presence of the Lord your God and rejoice, you and your household." So you spend the money on your festival expenses. This is pretty good. This is pretty good. Pretty good tithe. So ordinarily, you bring these tithes to Jerusalem. This is the second tithe. Remember, the first tithe, you already took 10%. You gave it to the Levites. That's gone. This is the second tithe. You take this to Jerusalem at one of the festivals, typically Sukkot, Feast of Tabernacles. But you take it and you use it on your festival expenses, which are significant because you have to imagine you have to make three huge family trips. Typically, I suppose that one of these trips is going to be a two-week commitment. So you got to make huge family trips, two-week journeys, three times a year. So it's a significant portion of expenses. So this is money that you can use in order to fulfill the commandments of keeping the festivals. I think, it must have been quite a party. The law of the second tithe ensured joyous and extravagant festivals. The collective joy of the people all gathered into the city, everybody spending liberally and giving liberally to everyone in need. It must have been the highlight of the year for the people. And then undoubtedly, I'm thinking that everybody was always looking forward, especially to Sukkot. Like, I can't wait for Sukkot this year. So the mitzvah of the second tithe, if we look at this prophetically, I think it foreshadows the coming day when all nations will ascend to Jerusalem. And they're bringing tribute to King Messiah, and they come up to Jerusalem. We're going to go up to Jerusalem. We say next year in Jerusalem at the pilgrimage festivals, because we're looking forward to the restoration of this. So anyway, how simple is this? First tithe, give it to the Levites. Second tithe, spend it on yourself at the festivals in Jerusalem. Well, sort of. But if we factor in another text here. Turn over to Deuteronomy 16. Verse 13 says, "You shall celebrate the Feast of Booths, Sukkot, 7 days, after you gathered him from your threshing floor and your wine vat, you shall rejoice in your feast. You, your son, your daughter, your male, your female servants, the Levite, the stranger, the orphan, the widow. Orphans, widows, Levites. They weren't in your family. 7 days you shall celebrate the feast of the Lord your God in the place which the Lord chooses, because the Lord your God will bless you in all your produce and in all the works of your hands, so that you will be altogether joyful. So, some of the second tithe has to go to the stranger, to the orphan, to the widow, in other words, to the poor. You can't just spend it all on yourself. Some of it has to go to the poor. How much of it? Well, I'll tell you what, here's how the sages figured it out. They worked this out like this. Say, okay, during the first year, the second year, and the fourth year, and the fifth year, is that right? First, second, fourth, fifth, years of the sabbatical, of the 7 year sabbatical cycle, the second tithe is set apart for the farmer, for himself, right, to take to Jerusalem. This is what's taken to Jerusalem. But during the third year and the sixth year, so 2 out of 7 years, it all goes to the poor and needy. When the tithe is for yourself, you have to take it to Jerusalem. You have to use it in Jerusalem. In the third year and the sixth year, you just give it to the needy. You give it to the food shelf. Your local needy. You need to kind of balance it out over 7 years, because at least 2 out of the 7 years are going to the poor and the needy among you. What about the tithe of the seventh year? There is no tithe in the seventh year. Seventh year is the Shemitah year. That's the year you take off from agriculture. So, do you know this is a Shemitah year this year? This year, right now, Shemitah. So, anyway, the commandments of tithing, again and again, I'm going to say this over again and again and again, they apply only to agriculture in the land of Israel while the temple system is functional. They are not currently applicable. Now, the Jewish community does practice certain ritual reminders in Israel of tithing on the produce of the land, but these are like a token remembrance of the real commandment. I've heard that in modern observance, the laws of tithing are observed, honored, not observed, but honored by redeeming one's tithe for a small coin, which is then, not really the full value of the tithe, but a small coin, a token amount, and then that's thrown into the sea, just to sadly remember, hey, we don't have Levites that are serving in the temple right now, so we can't do this right now. It reminds us that we're waiting for the day when Messiah comes. His dwelling place, the dwelling place of God on earth, is restored, and everyone's going to be going up to the holy city to keep the festivals with joy and to sit at the table of the king again. So, all right, those are the laws of tithing. Is that confusing? It's a little bit. I mean, there's the first tithe, the second tithe. The second tithe is divided up into different years. So you boil this all down to a practical level, though, and it means this. In today's world, there is no obligation to bring a tithe. But that's where Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob come in. They did not have an obligation to bring a tithe either, did they? And yet they did so willingly. They did so gladly. And I think, here's where I'm going to throw this out for you to consider. I think we should too. In fact, this is common in the Jewish community. It's the standard of setting aside a tithe. That's like the baseline. I think it should be a baseline. We should be giving 10% of our income in tithe. And if we want to fulfill the standard, the Torah standard, you know, we should be giving 10% to the work of the Lord, like that first tithe. It should be going to ministry. And another 10% should be split between festival expenses, your festival expenses, and charity for the poor and the needy among us, locally and in the world. So over and above these measures, then, above 20%, we should be just giving simple tzedakah. Just like you see a need, you meet the need. So, in other words, we should be given a lot of a healthy portion of the income after taxes. And the principle of tithing, I believe that, you know, I believe this actually holds true. And I'm not, you know, I've never talked about this before. So, you know, this isn't my deal. I'm uncomfortable with this. But I believe it holds true. The Master says, give and it will be given to you. They will pour into your lap a good measure, pressed down, shaken together, running over. And by the measure you use, it will be measured to you in return. I think, you know what I think? I think it's time for us as a community to take this on. And I encourage you to remember Beth Emmanuel with a portion of your tithes. I want to be clear with you, this is not a law. It is a principle that we learn from the law. And Beth Emmanuel, your local congregation, is not the temple. And those of us who receive compensation here are not Levites and we are not priests. So you are under no obligation to tithe to this community. But I would urge you to consider it. And I would certainly encourage you, in any case, regardless of, to tithe to the work of the Lord wherever you find it. Whether it's a ministry like World Vision or Compassion International. I like Voice of the Martyrs. I like First Fruits of Zion. I think they're doing good work. Beth Emmanuel, you know, is just Acts for Messiah. You know, God's work is happening all over, and it requires us to faithfully support it. We need to be givers. In the Didache, it says, happy is he that gives according to the commandment. Well, how do you give according to the commandment? That would be the tithe. Okay, let me transition away from it. I'm going to give you a pitch. Because I want to talk to you about how it is that we do what we do here in this community, how this community is supported. Now, here's the thing. You may or may not be aware of this. But out of respect for the Sabbath, we don't pass an offering plate here. The services are long. Maybe you never noticed, but we never pass an offering plate. We don't even put a box in the back of the sanctuary like we used to for you to drop your offering in. Why is that? Because we want to encourage you to begin to think about the Sabbath as a day when you don't use money. It's not a money day. Financial transactions, buying and selling, according to tradition, even handling or carrying money. You know, even carrying a quarter. These aren't done on the Sabbath. This is why Paul in 1 Corinthians, he writes to the Corinthians, says, now concerning the collection of the saints, as I directed the churches of Galatia, so you should do also on the first day of every week, each one of you is to put aside and save, as he may prosper, so that no collections will be necessary when I come. It's funny because this is used as evidence very often that believers are meeting on Sunday, first day of the week, says so, right there. 1 Corinthians chapter 16, verse 2. On the first day of the week. Actually, this is evidence they were keeping Sabbath. Because Paul would not tell them to be carrying money. In fact, they couldn't be carrying money on the Sabbath. So the first opportunity after Shabbat is the first day of the week. And he doesn't say assemble. He says set your money aside. Set it aside on the first day of the week. There's no offering plate being passed. So we don't collect money here on the Sabbath. And ordinarily, under ordinary circumstances, we don't even talk about money here on the Sabbath because it's the Sabbath. But we have great expenses. And if you're part of the community, you should be giving to the community. You should not be here, I'll put it in the language of Torah. Thou shalt not be a freeloader. You should be supporting this congregation. It doesn't matter if you regard it as a tithe or whatever. The point is that every one of us should be supporting the work of the Lord here. The wealthy man should give out of his wealth, and the poor man should give out of his poverty. 10%, I think, is a great biblical baseline. But I think some of you probably should be giving more. So I've been preaching since 2001, and I've never given us, hey, we need to support the community kind of sermon, right? You know, because... But I am today. Because it needs to be done. And that's part of it. But more because of the way we've chosen to honor the Sabbath. You need the reminder. Here's how we do it. How would you, even if you wanted to give money here, how would you do it? You wouldn't know. You need an envelope. We got these envelopes in the back. You pick up this envelope. It's got our address on it. You drop a check in it and you send us. And you know what? Then we get the check and you get a tax receipt at the end of the year. It's very simple. Or you can, we have an online system. You can do this online. The point is, we need to be supporting this community. Some of us have a problem with giving. And because of that, I think we are missing out on receiving commensurate blessing in return. And because of that, our finances do suffer because we are not disciplined givers. Now, fortunately, I'm not the treasurer of this congregation, never have been, don't know who gives what, or you know, who doesn't give what, or anything like that. And I certainly don't want to know those details. But every treasurer that we've ever had has always told me the same thing. There's a few people who do the giving, a minority of those who attend, who give regularly, and the majority don't. The majority don't support the congregation. I understand poverty. I've been poor. I know what it is to wait for the next miracle in order to put food on the table. But remember the Master's story of the widow's mite. It's an act of faith. It's one of the disciplines of faith. I understand reluctance to give to a community that seems to be, you know, it's like, because this is my story. It's like I look at Beth Manuel and say, oh, the lights are still on. So looks like we're doing okay there. I put the money someplace else where I say, I'm with this ministry. I see a need with this ministry. Boom, boom, like that, right? It's not really, you know, it's not, God's trying to work here. And I'm here. And I should be here. I see this as a basic part of being, you know, being a part of a community. It's like membership dues. My family, we're part of a community center, you know. We have a membership at a community center in St. Paul so that we can use their fitness center. And every month, for the privilege of using their facility, we have to pay dues. You know, it should be no different here. You use the facility, you should be supporting the facility. But more important than that, we should be supporting this community because we believe in what we're doing here. We believe in this mission. We believe in what God is doing here. And we want God to bless this community. And if we don't invest in the community, it's not a great statement of faith. Like, God, I think you should bless the community, but I'm not gonna. I believe in the mission of Beth Emmanuel. I believe in what we're doing here. Look, what are we doing here? Quick review. Sabbath community. We are a Sabbath community. We're restoring the Sabbath to the body of Messiah. This is a Torah community. We're returning believers to Torah. This is a center for those who practice Messianic Judaism. And Messianic Judaism is something worth getting behind. It is worth contributing to see this thing succeed. I believe in the future of the Hudson Messianic movement. I believe that Hudson, Wisconsin will become an epicenter for the Torah movement. Because it has the potential to become a real community, not just one day a week, but 7 days a week. And I believe we're going to build a mikvah. I haven't been able to communicate that. I don't think that to you how big and how foundational that is to us and to the restoration of this faith. But with God's help, we will. I know this, it will be expensive. We're going to do outreach. In the year to come, we're going to do more, making ourselves more visible through advertising, locally and nationally. Right now, our Sabbath sermons, you know, these Sabbath sermons that go out online all over the world, we have a virtual community of listeners that dwarfs our attendance here. But one of the main reasons I believe in giving to Beth Emmanuel is that Beth Emmanuel itself tithes. It's a little known fact. 10% of the money that we donate to the community goes back out to humanitarian concerns worldwide. We've done amazing work this way, around the world. Most recently, of course, our work with Acts for Messiah in Uganda. Building an orphanage, building a school. Next Sabbath, with God's help, I will be in Uganda. I will be teaching in Uganda. In Tororo, at the facility that you built. The fruit of the generosity of your hands. So my message is very simple. Consider what it is you are doing. What it is you're doing here. Why you are here. And why it is that you are not giving regularly to the community. or if you are giving regularly, why it is that you're giving regularly and could you be giving more. If you believe what's going on here, if you believe what we're doing here, you believe in what we're doing here, you should be financially invested in what we're doing here. If you don't believe in what we're doing here, you probably shouldn't be here. So, okay. I'll talk to you about this again in about 7 years. Let's get our finances in order. Let's test God in this matter. Let's become givers. Let's see what the Lord will do. Shabbat Shalom.